Hello, everyone. It's Gail McDonald here from Blind Spots. And today I have a very special guest who I've had the privilege of knowing for quite some time. I met Joel about 18-ish years ago. We were both coaches in the Edmonton area. And I was very intrigued because Joel is also a psychologist. And Joel has been working in this industry with many organizations for a very long time, around 30 years plus now. And I was so pleased when Joel agreed to come on to Blind Spots, because today we're going to be discussing how coaches can learn some things from psychology, because as you and I both know, Joel, that it's very, very different. Coaching and therapy just doesn't cross over. And yet there are some things that we could use that would still be within the guidelines of what is ethical when you're coaching with a client. So what are some of the skills that coaches may be able to add to their toolkit? And that is what Joel is going to share with us today. And I also had the pleasure of listening to Joel on another podcast with Scott Allen. And Joel is so experienced in many different areas, and we get to hear about some of that experience today. So Joel, once again, thank you so much. It's great to be here with you, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say, because it will be a first time for me as well. And as I shared with you earlier, you've always intrigued me right from the first time I met as well. How does someone be a psychologist and a coach? Like, aren't they different? And how do you cross over? So yeah. Joel, thank you very much. And just lay it on us. I'm so very interested.
Well, I work with polarities a lot. Two things that look like they're opposite, but they make an integrated whole. And even as you were talking, yes, coaching is very different from therapy. And it's not. I think part of the history on that is that the coaching community, in order to make a name for itself, to differentiate itself, it tended to have a lot of distinctions. And the distinctions were almost always great coaching against bad therapy, great coaching against bad consulting. Coaching is positive, therapy is negative. Coaches ask questions. Consultants tell you what to do. They were all false dichotomies as a way to justify the coaching was wonderful and better than everything else. And so it's true and it's not true. Like, you know, even right before you started recording, you said, if a client says, well, this feels just like therapy, you grimace like, no, it's not supposed to be. There's a line there. You can't cross it. Well, look, the foundation of both are exactly the same. To what extent can you create a context where somebody feels safe, where they feel held, they feel cared for? There's a sense of trust. They have a sense that you care about them deeply as a human being. And something in them goes, this is different from my normal experience. I can relax. I can be me. I can be vulnerable. I can share the things I haven't told anybody that scare me about my work, whatever. So, and I think that's the single most important skill in both areas. And so if a coaching client says, it feels just like therapy, I think that's just acknowledging that you did a really good job of creating a holding environment, which is exactly the same in both.
Okay. So I can relax now when they say that.
Yeah. Or even better, be a coach and say, what about it felt like therapy to you? And then you can sort of see where they take that.
Oh, I love that question, Joel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think there are a lot of false, you know, there's a bunch of gray area between. Mm-hmm. There's clearly places coaches should not go, both professionally and skill-wise. But there's a lot of gray area.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned as a another starting point. I have a colleague in the Bay Area who has executive coaches, runs a stable of executive coaches. I don't know the plural of, a bevy of. And she wanted her coaches to have four qualities to be really good executive coaches. One of them was a coaching model, which is the basic thing you get by going through any coaching program, to be able to frame a coaching conversation, to have desired outcomes, to explore for a while, to come to some kind of a conclusion, and to end up with some action steps. So you have a model. The second thing she wanted was someone who understood organizational cultures. I think one of the problems in coaching is that someone can be a very good individual coach and be a disaster organizationally because they don't understand organizational contexts, cultures, the impact of roles. They don't understand what it's like to be within a system. So she wanted people who had enough coaching experience to be able to work well, or maybe people who had been internal so they understood hierarchy and those kind of dynamics. That was number two. Number three was she wanted people to have some kind of a measure of individual differences among people, a way of understanding people, which is essentially psychology. How do you differentiate what drives different people, for example? And you don't need to have a psychology degree for that. I use the Enneagram a lot. It's my method of choice for getting under the hood for why people do what they do. There are other models like that. I think the Enneagram is the best one out there. But coaches need some way of understanding that all people are not the same, that they're driven by different things. And how do you understand that? Because just to riff on that one for a minute, I've taught coaching a lot. And sometimes I like to say, helping clients see the logical next step is the easy part of coaching. Having them understand why they didn't take it is one of the arts. Why didn't they follow through on that action plan? What made it so hard? And that doesn't require being a psychologist. It doesn't require, tell me about your parents or what it was like growing up. Tell me about your traumatic experiences. But it does require having some understanding of how do people get in their own way, what, and to have some model for working with that. Again, I think the Enneagram is a really good one for that because it's non-clinical, but it's very useful for understanding what motivates people.
And Joel,
And
while we're on, I'm sorry,
go ahead.
while we're on that, thank you, that topic of the Enneagram, might you spend a couple of moments and just give a layman's description of what the Enneagram is? You and I work with an organization that does provide that. I am not yet certified, but hearing you say that now, it really motivates me to want to do that. I've got the EQI as was required. But what, in your, in your words, in your definition, like what can one expect from the Enneagram, and what does that actually provide to a any type of practitioner, whether it's a coach or a therapist, psychologist? What does it show them to support the client?
Well, the first answer is it depends a lot. Nobody owns the Enneagram. There are wonderful Enneagram schools and ones that are not as good, in my opinion. There are some that are much better for working in businesses than others. There are a lot of people who say they're good at the Enneagram, but most of them aren't. You can't take a 2 to 4 day training in the Enneagram and feel like you really know anything about it. But the more you learn about it, the more depth it has. So I've been working intensely with it for 31 years. And the Enneagram used rightly looks at core strategies people have in life. What's that particular feeling that I want to have? Where if I get that feeling, life is good. I relax. Things are okay. If I'm not getting that feeling, then I try to think in ways to have that feeling. And then I also try to act in ways to have that feeling. People who have worked with Keegan and Leahy's immunity to change process kind of get at the same thing. Like, what's the core driver here? So there are nine strategies. Striving to feel perfect or beyond reproach, striving to feel connected to people, striving to feel outstanding, striving to feel unique, striving to feel masterful, or dis or I'll get the other word in a minute. I'm striving to feel secure, striving to feel excited, striving to feel powerful, striving to feel peaceful. Those are very different core motivations that then drive everything you do. So if you want to know why a leader overdoes being supportive over being challenging, it may be scary for them to raise attention in the room to point out discrepancies. Or they may feel like somebody won't like me if I point out something they're not doing. If you don't get at what's in the way, people will then be frustrated wondering, why don't I follow through? And so the Enneagram that I use, which is the Awareness to Action Enneagram model. So if people are interested, there's a really good podcast, the Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. There's the nine types, and then there are three instinctual biases, which have huge impact in all areas, but that model is particularly useful in business. About again, three, there are three patterns of instinctual biases, and we all have all three of them, but one of them is really center stage and understanding how that impacts us. And so if you get into that model deeply, which I think takes some years, but you can start right away, it gives you a way of understanding differences among people and also in a way of helping other people see what their strengths are, what their blind spots are, what their challenges are, what their habitual patterns are.
So barriers, those are the things that you had mentioned it a little bit earlier in different words. Once we find out what the barriers are, like feeling judged, what will people think is something that comes up a lot with a lot of the folks I work with, and being judged. Fear. I mean, fear is kind of the main barrier, but then there's all these other things that people are fearful of. And you mentioned something earlier as well that made me think about the knowing and the doing. That's kind of my terms. It's like, well, we know it, but then how do we then work with someone to support them in getting through those barriers? And I'm uncertain if this might be a question that could be discussed, but with those certain things like helping our clients determine the barriers and how might they work them through, how might we work with them to work them through, especially if they've done the Enneagram, what might be some of the variables between a therapist approach versus a coach approach?
Good question. And at some point, I want to come back to you. I mentioned that colleague had four things. I've mentioned three of them, so I want to come
Oh
back to the
yeah,
fourth.
we missed one. Yeah. Good. I'm glad you remembered.
But let's talk about this one first, and then we'll go
Okay.
to that
Thank you.
fourth one. Therapy, a therapist has access to going into the past, to examining trauma, to seeing where patterns could have come from. That a coach doesn't have, shouldn't have. But if, as a coach, if you know somebody has a pattern now, a deep need to be liked, a fear of conflict, you don't need to know where it came from. It's there now. And then the question is, how do you acknowledge that and then move forward? Well, one of the core ways is to help somebody see what do they care enough about to risk not being liked, to risk a sense of conflict, for example. So values are a really good way to move forward. Sometimes, and this is an art that comes with the Enneagram, you're taking what the person actually values, but taking it to a next octave. I'll give you an example. People who strive in to feel peaceful, they love harmony, they like things to be nice and smooth. Part of what they do is they tend to avoid conflict. I have songs that I use for games when I'm doing an Enneagram training. One of my songs for this type is Comfortably Numb, like Pink Floyd. They kind of go through life comfortably numb, but they're not dealing with the essential stuff. They're putting it off in some way. So one of the arts there is helping them see how they will get to a higher level of peace and harmony if they actually have that conversation, whether it's with their spouse or their kid or their boss or their colleague or their direct report, how you take what they actually are valuing, but you hold it up to a higher octave. You also do simple experiments. If somebody is having a hard time being straight with people about something they see that's not aligned with how things should be, find the easiest people to do that with first. Don't go for the hardest conversation first. Find things to lead up for that. If you want to try a new skill, if you're a leader who really loves being decisive and you feel very awkward being more collaborative, look at all the people you could work with and think who would be the easiest person to try a new style with. So you do little experiments.
It's a great suggestion for sure, and I've used that quite frequently in coaching. I mean, it's almost a life lesson. Like start small. If you're going to learn how to drive, you're not going to get into a three-quarter ton truck. That could end very badly. So, start small. For sure. That reminds me of years ago we purchased, I don't know why, a five-speed vehicle. And I wanted to learn how to drive it. And my husband said, please don't go out of the crescent. He saw how bad I was. And then after about, oh, a period of time, I felt like a rock star because I could drink coffee and put my lipstick on in the vehicle before the distracted driving law came to be.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, right? So Joel, might there be anything else that you could share with the audience about the distinctions, how to approach, in my mind, I heard change, start with something small. Anything else you might like to share?
Well, it goes back to the fourth one. So I'll do that and then I'll build in.
Excellent.
The fourth one was having a developmental model, which most coaching schools do not incorporate. So everyone knows there are models of child development, and that if you've been a parent, a 4-year-old is not just a small adult. They think differently. And there are changes that happen pretty reliably around age 4. Around age 8, around 12. Actually, I'll tell you a funny story in a minute about that. But they used to believe that once you got to be somewhere between 21 and 25, now you have an adult brain. It's now your job is to fill it full of stuff. And then this is a different part of psychology. This isn't clinical psychology, it's developmental adult psychology. People started finding that there were actually different worldviews, different ways of seeing life, ways of organizing things, ways of seeing oneself that are sequential that adults can move to or not. And part of the issue is that when you see a kid, you can pretty much tell by how big they are, what level they're thinking at. But all adults kind of look the same, whether they're thinking at quite an early level or a very later stage model of the world. So developmental models are ways of mapping what are these different ways of seeing the world, of seeing myself, that is sequentially more effective for everything in life, whether that's being a leader, whether that's being a parent, whether that's being, a spouse, a partner. And having a developmental model gives you a sense both of where somebody's functioning at. And that's important because coaches tend to ask questions they would like to answer. But depending on the developmental level of the co of the client, client may find them really annoying. And
Oh, interesting.
so understanding where somebody's functioning from is important. But that also gives you a sense of what the next stages could look like. Because even as coaches, our questions are never neutral. That's one of those lies in coaching. There's always an intention behind the question. So, and what are the things that tend to build people on a developmental level? The first core thing is reflection. Do you have a process of stepping back and asking yourself curious questions? You really can't develop without having some kind of a practice of reflection. Sometimes when I work with coaching clients, I say, I'm going to kind of badger you until you try one. So you might as well try it. And to me, the minimum one is in the morning, setting an intention for who you want to be today, how you want to show up, how you want to impact other people. Not what are the things I want to get done, but who do I want to be? And at the end of the day, take a few minutes and reflect back with compassion, not with being self-critical. How did today go? Kind of play it through in your mind. So that's reflection. The other two that are really important are perspective taking and seeking. And so a lot of my coaching questions are perspective taking questions. The distinction there is perspective taking, I do in my own mind. So if I'm sitting here right now and wondering, how is Gail with this dialogue right now? Is she happy? Is she interested? Is she going, what's this guy talking about? That's perspective taking. If I reach across and I ask about your perspective, that's perspective seeking. So those are two very different skills, related but very different. A lot of the coaching questions I ask are developmentally informed. So you want to have a difficult conversation with your boss. Can you put yourself in your boss's shoes? What do you know about him or her? And how might you bring this up in a way where they would welcome it? That's actually a very sophisticated question. It's a brain stretch. I do some couples coaching. My work's about 80% organizational, about 20% the other side of life. When a couple comes in, I don't usually ask them, how have things been this week or this month? I say, what will your partner say about how things have been? What will your partner say about what it's been like having you as a husband or wife or whatever the relationship might be? I do a lot of them reaching across and trying to put themselves in the other person's shoes. I also do perspective taking in the sense of, yes, about helping people move through difficult situations. If somebody says, I have a difficult conversation coming up with somebody, I will often say, imagine that the conversation's over, you're headed home, and you're thinking back on this dialogue. What would you most like to be, sorry, what would you most like to be able to say about how you showed up, about what qualities you embodied? Because that frames the entire thing. Now, this difficult conversation I'm having is one possibility, one opportunity to be my best self. And perspective seeking, we know that One of the core things that great leaders do is they really seek out other people's perspective. So I'll mention this quickly. I think you'll enjoy this. This goes back to the DND work that we both do. So I'm working with a very senior officer who said, I always know the right thing to do, so I don't really bother having a lot of dialogue. I'm just into moving, quickly, getting things done. And I said, good, you always know the right thing to do. I'm going to tell you something about development. And what I do is, and I do this playfully, I talk about some of the examples that get used with four-year-olds. This is Piaget's experiments with kids who are what's called pre-operational. One of the standard ones is you have a glass of water that's in a wide glass. You pour it into a cylinder. You ask the child, is there now more water, less water, or the same? And they say more, because they can only handle one dimension at a time. Now it's taller, so there must be more. My favorite, the one that I used with this guy, I love this one. The experiment it takes puts one cracker in front of the kid and two crackers in front of herself and says, is that fair? And the child goes, no.
Of course not.
Then, but then the experiment that takes that kid's cracker, breaks it in half, separates it out, says, now is that fair? And the kid says, yes. Because again, they only handle one dimension at a time. Now they have two and two. They don't really get that they're different sizes. And so I said to this senior officer, what's interesting about that is that the child is totally sure. The child doesn't say, oh, I'm not sure if it's fair. They are absolutely sure that it is. And so I said, at every developmental level, people are quite sure of themselves when they're in the middle of their level. So how do you know if you're a brilliant strategist or if you're like the four-year-old?
Well, I would say there are days when I am like the 4-year-old, more days than I would want that I would choose to admit. And some days, brilliant strategist, that's a bit of a stretch, but I do come up with some things that are quite wise.
Well, it turns out that this officer was haunted by that all week. When he was about to make a decisive decision, he wondered, I'm sure of myself, but from what level? And so that led to the next assignment, which is, even though you're sure of yourself, for the next while, you'll tell your team, here's what I think I want to do. And then your question for them is going to be, what am I missing? That's perspective seeking. And so the instability that I help generate with the developmental thing created more of an opening to wonder, what level do I really function at? And one of the ways to find that out is to be open to other people's perspectives and genuinely ask, what might I be missing here?
Well, thank you, Joel, because I find that extremely insightful, particularly as a coach. And what I've been hearing a couple of times in the last month-ish from different areas, and what I'm speaking about is your example of, like the exercise with the child and then sharing that with an adult and discovering, like you say, what level do people actually operate on? And we sometimes don't even know ourselves. And the word instability to me feels good. Because if we're not feeling sort of knocked off our perch a little bit, then where is the room for development and growth?
True.
And what I have been hearing is even one of my clients said, today I had to do adult, but Yesterday, I felt like I was the 8-year-old. And I believe, too, I saw a clip that Mel Robbins put out. And she was talking about just that, about adults looking like adults. And you mentioned it before with size. Kids, we know we're kids. Adults were, we're different shapes and sizes, but we certainly know we're adults, or others are adults. But sometimes we really are 8-year-olds in an adult body.
Yeah, and that shows one of those really subtle overlaps between coaching and consulting. Coaches can use models like internal family systems. They can say, okay, so, Gail, your 7-year-old showed up. What do you know about your 7-year-old? Like, what's important to her? Other parts show up. Okay. So, how can you make sure when you have that important meeting that adult Gail shows up and not the 7-year-old? What would that be like? And you can use techniques that come from some of those, like, you are the driver in the car, the 7-year-old's in the back seat, bopping around with headphones, and all parts are welcome, but only one part's allowed to drive, and that's the adult. I've had people go into meetings taking the younger part of them and putting it behind their back, and they say before the meeting, I've got your back, I'll handle this, because they know what that younger part's scared of. A coach can do that. What a coach shouldn't do is, let's go back to where that came from. What happened to you when you were 7? What kind of traumatic things happened? What was going on? So you can, that's why I'm saying there's tons of overlap where you can take a model and really use it in either domain as long as you're clear where your boundaries are.
Critical piece to boundaries. We speak about boundaries so often in coaching. And one thing I've learned over the years is that I also have to have them within myself, the boundaries I have to implement with myself to exercise that caution when I am working with someone as a coach to know where my own boundary is about which direction do I go with this question. And I appreciate what you said earlier is it's about, let's move forward instead of looking at what happened to create this. And as a coach, there's sometimes a question that I ask, and I would love your opinion on this, because it's something likely that other coaches may ask as well. But sometimes folks will say, well, I really have to think about that and question why I do it or what happened to me in my childhood or what. And I haven't even brought that up because I know that's not it's not the sandbox that I'm supposed to be playing in. And the question that I have for them is, how might that make a difference? Like, or is it going to make a difference to you if you know where it's coming from versus let's take a look at how we might do this differently. And as you just said, take the 7, 8-year-old, put them behind you who has to show up right now. So to me, that just indicates there's a lot of, is it fair to say, internal dialogue that we need to have? Like, where does that come from, Joel, when we're working at changing certain things, whatever it may be that the client wishes to change, to like going through that process of like our minds, because it's everything is in between our ears. And I have some really interesting conversations with myself, particularly when things are challenging. And I think I just asked you about two or three questions all at once. So I'll just, not a great coaching move, right? But we're not here for coaching. We're here for just talking about whatever we can, right? So I'll just maybe let you grasp onto whichever one you felt was sort of the top one you might want to answer or speak to.
Well, The ability to reflect on why we're doing what we're doing is vital
Okay.
in anything. And so to have somebody say, I really want to know where this comes from, you can certainly invite them to make some times, set a timer for 10 minutes, 3 times this week, and just ask yourself, I wonder what's so scary to me about conflict, for example.
Okay.
If they bring up something that's historical, then there is a choice point for a coach of if what you want to do is to explore that historically, that's not what coaches do, but I can help you find a good therapist for that.
Right.
Which does not mean that I won't still coach you. It just may be that that's something that you do separately. But you can also move forward with that. So if I came up with, I had an abusive parent, an abusive father, and when this conflict, I feel the same fear I felt when I was a 4-year-old. Okay. As an experiment, I wonder what would happen when you go into the next conversation that you know is going to have some tension to say to yourself, that was then, this is now, this is not my father. That could be a coaching move.
Got it.
I'm not going back into the past, but I'm trying to differentiate conditions.
So what I'm hearing is that you're acknowledging what they have said about, oh, I'm gonna have to think about why I'm fearful of this, or so not being dismissive, acknowledge it, but then create that clarity where it might be time to have a therapist referred,
Yeah,
and then moving forward.
which also goes into, I think, one of the questions you had about when do you refer? And coaching is an action-oriented model. The value of coaching does not really happen in the coaching session. It happens after the coaching session with taking action, learning from it, cycles of action and reflection. If someone consistently cannot move forward, that's a therapy referral. No matter how hard they try, they're diligent, they can't get past something. They can't have a difficult conversation. They can't risk being liked, being disliked. That's a good reason to refer.
Okay,
You
that's
know,
very clear.
because there's content areas that require referral, suicidal, homicidal, major addiction. There are also process reasons, like difficulty moving forward. There are also process things like I did a talk for the Edmonton ICF, I think 9 years ago, about the interface of coaching and psychology. And part of what I said is coaches are always told, make sure you refer if it's a psychological issue, but they're not told, how do you know when it is one? One of them is a weird feeling you have as a coach or as a practitioner that something's scary about this person. Not that they're going to hurt you, but there's something disquieting. There's something going on, and I'm just feeling uncomfortable being around them. That's often a sign that there's some deeper psychological issue to work with, for example. Or I notice myself holding back. or I notice, I'll change in a different direction. Do you know? Window of tolerance as a model, Stan Siegel.
From the title, I'm making an assumption, but that's rarely safe, so I can't say I do know it intimately. So I would
Okay.
love to hear it.
The idea is that we all have a different range of arousal, and there's a point in between that's the window where we're good. We are responsive instead of reactive. We have full use of our frontal lobes. We can be adaptive and think critically, and we can be empathetic with ourselves and others. And whatever our current level of functioning, we're at our best. We can leave that at the top or at the bottom. At the top is overly agitated, enraged, highly anxious. We can leave that at the bottom. Numb, dissociated, frozen. There are subtle way signs that we're leaving at the top. It could be fawning. We just keep on sort of dismissing ourselves to try to make peace. At the bottom, it's just kind of being disengaged, just unmotivated. When we're out of our window of tolerance, either way, we become binary. Our thinking becomes constricted. We become kind of a blunt object. We don't see other people as people. We see them as objects that are in our way or not in our way. And we usually act in ways that later on we go, what was I thinking? So I often say to leaders, your first job is to stay within your window and to recognize when you're leaving it and to have skills to come back into it. The same is true for a coach. Am I in my window of tolerance while I'm with this person? If the client cannot stay in their window, if they keep on getting enraged and agitated to a point where they can't do anything about it, even when you teach them some breathing skills, whatever, or they're just numb, they're frozen, they have a sense of disreality and they just kind of can't come back. Those are very important signs of referring.
And Joel, what might a coach do if that is suggested that perhaps, this is like you gently let them know, like this isn't about coaching. Might I refer you to a therapist, and they just say, maybe they are very disrespectful or dismissive, or and they're being rude. What action could you take in that moment where you could just end the call? And then what would you do? Like, what type of perhaps follow-up would there be? Or and there could be a difference whether you're contracted and they're working for someone, or maybe it's just an individual one-on-one client that you met somewhere. Anything you could share with our coaching audience?
Yeah, a few things. And as you're talking, I'm sort of triaging different possibilities out of that. One of them is that I think it got better. The ICF used to have a really bad handout about those situations where you would just refer out, and that was all that you did. In psychology, this may still be true. The single biggest thing you could do to for a malpractice suit would be to have sex with a client. The second biggest one is I just lost the word for a minute, is abandonment. And we never want to abandon somebody we're working with. That's not humane. That's not ethical. So it's not going to be, if you don't call somebody right now about your alcohol problem, I'm never going to see you again. That's not humane, and it's also not wise professionally. The first question in my triage thing is a person safe? If the person has expressed suicidal, homicidal thoughts, you are required to call whoever might be appropriate. It might be the police for a health and welfare check. I've done that twice in my coaching career. Once where somebody, actually, the person's wife said that he went off in the mountains with his shotgun and said he wasn't coming back. And once, actually, more recently in the last couple of years here, where somebody was expressing thoughts of self-harm and would not do any follow-through. And so I called the police for a health and welfare check. The other is somebody, let's say, you know that they have a major addiction of some kind and they're not dealing with it. To coach while exploring, help me understand. It's like doing motivational interviewing, which is a good series of techniques. Help me understand what would be in the way of you wanting to get help for this. What would motivate you to seek help? Motivational interviewing has a lot of questions that don't push people, but sort of has them look at both what's in their way and what could help them move forward. And it might even be saying, as a coach, I think you need to deal with this issue. You're spending 5 hours a day watching pornography, and I don't think you're going to get where you're going while you're doing that. I'm willing to meet with you for a little while and just to keep on sort of looking at this issue and kind of what it would take.
Joel, I can't thank you enough for all of this information, because it is so valuable. And when I was a new coach, we're told these things in training that there could be the likelihood that you will come across certain situations that are out of your hands and need to be addressed. But you made it very real. And I think when new coaches hear this information, that it's important to know that it is a reality. And there are certain responsibilities we have and certain responsibilities we don't have, and what we need to do about it. So it's just really been very, very supportive. And of course, as a young coach, I remember myself thinking too that, oh my gosh, I have to resist the temptation because this isn't my problem to fix. So what do I need to ask? And if we're that fixer personality, then it's something that really needs to be addressed. And sometimes it's very difficult. And
Which, by the way, also goes into why having a mentor coach is so important. Because do you have
oh
somebody
yes.
that you talk to say, I'm just feeling weird with this person, or I'm just feeling stuck, I don't know what's going on, or it's just bring up things that are happening and to get somebody who has experience to reflect back.
Yes, and we also need to be the best receivers of our own advice. You know, when we're, I mean, clients are coming to us as coaches, and yet we're not perfect. We don't have all the answers, and we need support. And caregivers need caregivers. Therapists need therapists. You know, everyone that's dealing with humans needs support from someone that understands what it takes and the challenges that may occur, because we can't possibly have all the right answers. And I'm also wondering too, Joel, if in the roles that you play, as we get close to wrap up here, might there be anything to share with the audience about how to, if your client hasn't disclosed, how to work with someone who you, like you say, you have that feeling, right? That they might be neurodivergent in some way, you know, in this on the spectrum in some way. Are they ADHD? I've only had it happen once where it wasn't disclosed, and it was pretty delicate because it was challenging to kind of move ahead with this person. And they were relieved, actually. But I hesitated, but I thought I'm just going to go for it. And again, back to your interview with Scott, I recall, and I can't remember exactly what it was, maybe you will, but I recall you saying something to a client that was just like super direct, bang on, what are you going to do about it? Or something like that. And I'm like, yep, that's sometimes what's necessary, but still requires some thought and technique and experience to do so. So how might you address the area of neurodivergencies?
It feels like a lens I've only had relatively recently, and I think a lot of people have. And that when I first started exploring what that could mean, I started thinking about all kinds of clients and going, of course. Duh.
Well said. I think I use that same word with myself. Ding ding.
I think what's really important is to know that we all humans are on all kinds of continuums. We're all narcissistic to some extent. We're all, the question is how far out from the norm are we? But we're all on all these continuums. And to not use labels for people, because that gets pejorative, but to be able to say to somebody, I think you process people differently than a lot of people. What do you think? Or, I mean, I've had people in the military who to me are on the spectrum, and where now they're being told they have to engage people more, and it's not easy for them. But you don't have to label it. You can just go, we all have strengths and challenges. Some of us are better at the task end of life. Some of us are better at the people end of life. Some of us read people's emotions pretty well. Some of us don't so well. There's all these different dimensions. Where do you think you are on that? And when you're in a dialogue, how easy it is for you to read what's going on for somebody emotionally. The person go, oh, it's kind of hard. Well, do you think you'd be more effective at your work if you got a little better at it? Let's talk about that. I think labels are problematic, but the idea that we're all on these different continuums makes it much, it normalizes it.
Yeah, I would definitely tend to agree with you on that. And one other thing, if you don't mind me bringing up the other interview, I thought it was absolutely amazing
Thank
when
you.
you talked about a good leader needs to regulate their nervous system.
Yeah.
And I thought of that as you spoke about we are all of it. We all have narcissistic tendencies. Everything that we talk about and every sort of characteristic, emotion, behavior, to varying degrees. And but I mean that to me, I find that super interesting because how boring the world would be if we were all the same. Ew, seeing about 20 of me in the same day, I don't know if I'd like that very much.
Yeah, and we all can look at all kinds of times when we hit the send button, we were sure it was the right thing to do, and then all hell broke loose, and later on we said, what was I thinking? And so it's very easy to introduce to a leader, how do you know when you're reactive? How do you know when you're responsive? What are the early warning signs when you're starting to move out of that window? How can you recognize those, and get some strategies? Because you're, no matter how evolved we are potentially, when we're out of our window, like I said, we're just blunt instruments.
Ouch. Okay,
Me
well,
too, not.
yeah, absolutely. I'll have to remember that one for sure. Joel, is there anything else you would like to share that would support the coaches that are going to listen to this podcast? Any summary of wisdom or anything you could, any words of wisdom you could share with them?
Well, I mean, particularly when you're a newer coach, the issue of making money in this profession is key. And that will create a bias to not wanting to see reasons to refer or not wanting to question whether I'm the right person for somebody because I don't want to lose the income. I mean, that's reality. We can all say we're in this field just for magnanimous reasons. We want to have the world be a better place, but most coaches are trying to make a living. And so that's why either having core self-honesty or having a really good mentor coach, do I really feel like this coaching is going well? Do I really feel like I'm helping this person? Is something disquieting to me? I mean, I remember having a client years ago who kept raving about me, but I could never really make sense of what they were saying, but I didn't want to say that. And it really almost came back to haunt me. So can we be honest about, even do I think I'm the right person for somebody? So again, there is a core self-honesty of, is this really going well? Am I feeling okay? Am I feeling like I'm being used well? And if not, do I have somebody I can talk to at least process that and see whether maybe I could be doing something different? Maybe I'm the wrong person.
Absolutely. And that's okay. However we think about the situation, however we think about us, That's okay. And even after, as long as I've been doing this, after a call, I'll reflect and go, was that the best question I could have asked them?
Sure.
Because we are human, right? So I know I sometimes have self-doubt. I've learned to deal with it, of course, over the years in more productive ways, but there are those odd times where I think about the question I've asked. I know one thing for sure, though. I love it, and I'm thinking you love it and you enjoy it wholeheartedly. And I'm very delighted that our paths crossed again, and that you agreed to be with me today on the podcast. I'm really very, very grateful. And there is a book that you have written,
True.
and where can we reach you? We'll put that in the show notes on YouTube. So, what would you like to share with the audience on that?
The book is called Clear Impact, Building Your Leadership Capacity. Available in all the usual channels on Amazon, it's on Kindle. It's gotten really good reviews. And my website is clear-impact.com. And some years back, I decided to be totally open source about everything I know. And so I just started putting it out on the internet every time I thought about a model that I've used or developed. And so I have a Medium channel for Clear Impact that has a lot of stuff. Forbes has published 70 of my articles now on the Forbes Coaches Council.
Wow,
And every,
congratulations. That's a lot. 70.
well, thanks. Well, what happens is every time I think about some new, something I haven't shared, I just put it out there because I really want everything that I've explored to be out there in the public domain. So it's all out there.
That's beautiful. Thank you for doing that and not just holding it tight to your chest. But that's how we grow, and that's how we create community and belonging, is by sharing information and just helping people be the best version of themselves. So, thank you again.
You're
And
welcome.
I'm sure we'll see you in another meeting soon. But yeah, I just wish you all the best, and it's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been delightful.
Yeah, thank you, Joel, so much.
You're welcome.